Our next speaker is Amos Wong. She is director of Key Perspectives Limited, consulting and convener of the organization Enabling Open Scholarship. And it's only fair to say that Alma is a celebrity in the open access arena, and her talks are always highly enjoyable. So Alma will speak about the benefits of repositories today.
Good morning, everybody. I would like to just remind you that people like me are the general public of Europe who benefit from open access. I run a small consultancy which sits outside the university world, although we do work alongside universities, of course, and work with them in many cases, but we do not have access to university library holdings. So when we need to get hold of academic outputs, we have to search the open access literature and hope that what we're after is there. And I'm not alone, of course. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of engineering firms, of family doctor practices, of law firms, of architectural companies, all of whom are in the professional community who would like to be able to see the outputs of university research. Now, my talk is focused specifically on repositories. You've heard quite a lot from Paul already about repositories. One of my slides, at least, is the same as one of Paul's, so we can move quickly through that bit of the talk. What I want to do is emphasize the benefits of repositories to different stakeholder groups. So I'm going to start by talking to those of you in the room who are researchers, authors, and then I'm going to move on to focus a few of my words on those of you who are university managers or administrators, policymakers in the research world. And indeed, if we have anybody from Austria's national policymaking team, then those remarks will apply to you too. So the context then for my talk is this. I'm just going to give you a very quick definition of what open access is. It is the immediate, and that's important, and I shall come back to explain why that's important later in my talk. The immediate free to use, that is, you don't have to pay for access, free of restrictions on the use, access to the peer-reviewed literature, and now we're extending this to data as well, the data that support those literature outputs. It is not vanity publishing that you can just pay and have something published like you can with some book publishers that publish novels or books of poems. You can pay to have your own work published in that area. This is not what we're talking about here. It's not vanity publishing. It's not, oh, let's stick everything up on the web and not bother with peer review. We're talking about the peer-reviewed literature that you work with if you are authors and researchers. And it is moving scholarly communication simply into the age of the web from the age of print on paper. That's what it's doing. How do you make your work open access? Well, there are open access journals, and this afternoon's session is devoted to open access journals, so I am not going to say any more about those here. You will hear a lot about those from the experts this afternoon. Open access repositories is the subject of my talk, so I shall be going into much more detail about those. And for those of you who may work in the humanities disciplines, which are primarily book-based, and books are the main output, we are now looking into a future of open access monographs and books, which is very exciting. There's a lot of work going on in this area, and some big advances in terms of the publication of books in open access form. And of course, books in open access enjoy the same kind of highlighted visibility and impact that open access journal articles do. So, to the repositories. These are digital collections. They're usually institutionally based, but sometimes they are subject-based or centralized repositories, collections on a specific topic. There are two very prominent examples of these. There's PubMed Central, which is a life sciences open access collection, and there's something called the Archive, which collects content in high energy physics and related fields. But mostly we're talking about repositories that are in universities or research institutes. They are interoperable, by which I simply mean that they all work on the same basic technology. There is an international agreement about the standards, the technical standards that these repositories work on, so that they all expose or show to web search engines their content in the same way. And this means that things like Google and Google Scholar and Yahoo and the other search engines can index those repositories and form a big global database of research. So we have a network of repositories around the world. I don't want you to think of the repository in your university, if it has one already, as being a standalone thing. It isn't. It's a node in a big global network consisting of all the other repositories. They're indexed by Google. If you put your work in your repository today, Google will have indexed it within 24 hours, and it will show up in Google Scholar tomorrow. So we have a global database of open access research. There are currently more than 1,600 repositories, as Paul showed us, and this is where they are. He showed us that, so I can move on. How you make your work open access through a repository. I want to just work through this slide, the steps that you do, just to re-emphasize that I'm talking about the peer-reviewed literature, which of course is what you produce if you're researchers, not something different. This is how you fit it into your own workflow. You prepare your paper, as usual, and you submit it to the journal of choice, as usual, for peer review. So nothing different yet. The journal will have it peer reviewed and will send you back the reviewer's comments. And sometimes they require only a few tiny things doing, and sometimes they'll say, do 5 more experiments and send us the paper back. You hope not to get those kind of review comments. Anyway, you make those changes, you do your extra experiments, you finish the paper, and you send it back to the journal in the final form. At that time, when you have that final version ready, it'll probably be in Word, or if you're a mathematician or physicist, you might be preparing your papers in some other format. That doesn't matter. Whatever format you have it in, you then put it in your repository. That's your copy of your work. You've also sent it to the publisher of your journal, and it's going to be published. It's peer-reviewed, you've made the changes, it's going into the repository at that time. Immediate open access. I'll come back to why I'm emphasizing that in a minute, because it has huge benefits for you if you do it like this. In most universities, the library staff or whoever's running the repository will have plenty of resources available to provide advice to you about this. If you're worried about contravening copyright, or you're worried about publishers' embargoes, or whether you've signed all your rights away to a publisher, or whether you should sign all your rights away, or whether you should even sign any of your rights away, your library will be able to advise you. So take them up on that. They are the experts. Okay, so that's how you do it. Now what's in it for the authors? Now here's something that was sent to us in an answer on one of our very early surveys on this matter. This is a philosopher. I think he was in an American university. And he said this. This is one of the areas where there is a subject-based repository, philosophical science. And he said, effectively, I put my work in this repository. It's given my work worldwide visibility. And all sorts of people have noticed it. I've been invited to conferences. I've been invited to submit work to journals and so forth. So that was an early testimony, if you like, about the visibility that open access brings to work. So that's the first thing I'm going to talk about, visibility and usage. Now, here's a well-filled repository, what I call a well-filled repository. This is a repository at school level, not university level. It's the School of Electronics and Computer Science at the University of Southampton. It was actually the very first open access repository. It was built in 2002, and it had a mandatory policy put on it in February of 2003 by the head of school. Everything that's published from that school goes into the repository. It's put there by the authors, and it currently has something like 15 or 16,000 items in it. They're not all journal articles. Many of them are from peer-reviewed conferences because, of course, this is an engineering discipline, and peer-reviewed conferences are really the primary way of disseminating work in those disciplines. But it also has other things. It has PowerPoint presentations that people have done. It has software put in there. It has supporting data sets, audio files, video files. It has all sorts. But it also has the journal articles and the peer-reviewed conference papers. This is the kind of usage that that repository is getting. So these are monthly figures. So you can see the bars there for each month. This is the number of downloads of the articles in that repository. The average is 30,000 a month for those 15,000 items. So that's not bad. And don't forget that this is new usage. This is usage by people who cannot get to the original subscription journals and conferences. These are people who are disenfranchised in that respect, and they're finding this work through the open access repository. Now, here's another testimony, because I think these speak better to researchers than anything I can say to them, really. This is a professor at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. He was asked by the Deputy Vice Chancellor, who made the policy at that university, what the repository had done for him. And what he's saying here is that it has given him higher citations, which I'm coming on to talk about next. But primarily, he thinks the best thing is that it's given extra usage from people who'd never had access to his work before. He mentions here Malaysia, which of course is an important potential partner for Australian researchers. Australian researchers are looking all the time now to partner and cooperate and collaborate with other researchers around the Pacific Rim. Malaysia is one of those countries. And this man knows very well that his work is getting a lot of usage from people in those countries that never had access to it before. So that's one of the things he thinks their ePrints repository has done for him. So visibility and usage is one thing. Impact is another. Now, I'm sure that you are just as concerned, if you're researchers, about the impact of your work as British researchers and American researchers are, where citation impact is really the currency, at least in the natural sciences. This slide shows the percentage increase in citations for papers that are open access compared with those in the same issue of the same journal that are not open access. So the experiment was that a robot crawled the web looking for a paper that was open access. When it found it, it looked at what journal it had been published in. So we are assuming that it found it in a repository, okay, in exactly the way I told you earlier. The author had published the work in a journal and put it in his repository. Once it found a paper like that, it looked for that issue of that journal to find a paper in that issue that was not available in open access. So it's as near as you can get to comparing like with like. And then it counted the number of citations to both papers. Did that for tens of thousands of papers. And then these are the summary results. Now, the percentage increase in citations does vary from discipline to discipline. But in every discipline tested, there is an increase in citations with open access. And let's say that the average is something like 50%. That's important to you. Now I'm going to show you how that works out for one individual researcher. This man's called Ray Frost. He's at Queensland University of Technology, the one I just mentioned. And he is an inorganic chemist. He does write a lot of papers, I have to say. And we've been waiting for someone who's written a lot of papers and started depositing them in an open access repository so that we can do the kind of analysis that I'm going to show you now. So here's our best man to date, really, because he's published hundreds of papers, 501 in that repository over the last few years. So, I don't think there's anyone in this room that can beat that, but you never know. See me afterwards if you can. Anyway, so great. 500 papers. There you are. There it says there at the bottom there. Number of items, 501. Ray Frost. Actually, they're not quite all journal articles. Some are book chapters, and I think he's got a few books as well, so heaven knows when he sleeps. But anyway, there we go. He's very prolific. He's at the top of the author list for downloads from that repository. This shows the top authors for downloads, and you can see his name there. You can see that in total, he's had 180,000 downloads of those 500 articles. And this year, or in fact, that was last year. I made this slide in September of last year. By that time, in that year, he'd had nearly 25,000 downloads of those of his articles. So that's the kind of readership he's getting from people who do not have access to his papers in journals. This is new readership, the kind of thing you can get. So let's see what it's done to his impact. Now, these are graphs from the Web of Science. I expect most of you have seen this kind of thing. If you're researchers, you've probably generated these for yourself for your own work. The Web of Science will show you and will do what they call a citation analysis. So on the left, we see the number of papers published in each year by Ray Frost. And as you can see, they have gone up a bit over the years, but not massively so. On the right-hand side, you can see the number of citations to papers by Ray Frost, measured by the Web of Science. Now, in 2004, the mandate went on to that repository, and Ray Frost obediently started putting his papers in the repository. So that's when he started making his work open access. And what you can see is that up until then, the number of citations to his papers were more or less steady. But from 2004 onwards, they have skyrocketed. He has published a few more papers, but not that number more. So this is the open access effect on Ray Frost's citations. Now, I have done this with other researchers from that university. Last week, I was at a very small and very new research university in the UK. And I looked in their repository and found three of their researchers who had over 50 papers, and I did the same thing with their researchers and got the same picture. So when your university's repositories start collecting that kind of content from you, you researchers in the room, you will be able to watch your citation impact go up too as a result of making your work open access. Now I'm coming back to the immediate thing, because I do keep emphasizing this. It's so important to make your work open access early. The early bird catches the worm, as we say in English. I'm sure you say much the same thing in German. Incidentally, my German would last for, I think, 5 minutes, and I could tell you when my birthday is and wish you a happy Christmas and ask you where you live and what your favorite subjects are, but that's it. So, anyway, the early bird catches the worm. This work was done by a group from CERN and from the SLAC Linear Accelerator in Stanford in California. And what they did was they looked at citations to papers published in a group of high-energy physics journals, and they're listed there, and they compared them to citations to articles published in those journals and also made open access. So it's the same kind of experiment as I described before. And you'll see, so the red line shows citations to articles published just in the journals. And the green line shows citations to the articles also made open access. And as you can see, there are more citations. You can also see that the gap gets bigger as time goes on. And it starts very early. So in other words, the earlier you make your work open access, the better. And you can expect to see a gap forming in the number of citations. In other words, those lines never become asymptotic. They never become parallel or catch up again. The journal articles enjoy a certain number of citations, but those made open access as well enjoy a permanent, persistent open access citation advantage. Now that's high energy physics, and the work has been followed up in other disciplines now, lots of them, so I'm just going to show you three. It works out the same in all, but I'll just show you three. There's engineering. You can see the difference between the non-open access work and the open access work. It's persistent and increasing, that advantage. Clinical medicine and social science. So it's not just high energy physics. Okay, so that's usage and visibility advantage, its impact advantage. And I want to just show you what else your repository can do for you. It can tell you who is using your work. So this is an article written, I'm using one of my own here so I don't pick on somebody else. This is a book chapter actually that I wrote, and I put it into the repository at Southampton because I have an affiliation there. Once it had been peer reviewed and accepted for publication in the book. So there it is. This is what the repository can show me about my article. It shows me this dashboard, and there are various things on it. There's downloads, you can see those. It can show me who's referring people in, i.e. are they coming in mainly by Google, or are they coming in the front door of the repository? It can show me links that are referring people in, so whether there's a conference that's pointed to my article or whether it's in Wikipedia or something. It's not, but sometimes articles are. But the best, the most exciting thing of all, apart from this download, which is obviously interesting, is this for researchers. It's who is using your work. Now, this repository software called ePrints, very common software, can show the domain, the academic domain from which downloaders are coming. So I can see there, for example, that three people at Cornell and three at the Australian National University and a couple at the University of Melbourne and so forth have downloaded that article. Now that isn't many downloads. This is not an article that is going to set the world on fire. But some articles can and do, and it's very interesting and useful for authors to see where the usage is coming from. And we have heard time and time again of people being so interested in this that they have worked out, they've followed this up, worked out who is using their work, got in touch with them, and have established new collaborations as a result. So this is changing the way that people work. And incidentally, downloads are a very good predictor of eventual citations, and the man who did the work on that is going to speak to you later in this program. So finally, another advantage for you researchers is this. If you are working in a discipline where you wish to find industrial collaboration or commercial collaboration, be aware that most companies that will be interested in your work and in collaborating with you do not buy the journals that you publish in. They have to find your work in another way and find out that you're doing it and come along and ask if you would like some money to do some research. Now, the EU periodically does community innovation statistics surveys. And this last one showed this headline. There is a weak link between innovative enterprises, that is, small companies that innovate, and public research institutes and universities. That was the headline of that survey. It's not how universities want it to be, of course, because they all want industrial money. There's figures that go behind that statement. This is the people that companies find to collaborate with when they want to do innovative work. And at the top, you'll see there are all sorts of things there, including their customers and their competitors. They find information from these sources. At the bottom here are universities and public research institutes. 3% of companies manage to find information that they need to innovate from universities. So that's a very bad situation across Europe. Now I'm going back to Queensland University of Technology because I have one more set of data from there that follows on from this. This is provided by Tom Cochrane, the Deputy Vice Chancellor, who introduced the policy on open access. This is the research income for the Australian universities as a whole. There are 38 of them in Australia. So this is the aggregate increase in research income over the last few years for those universities, and it's gone up by 68% over 5 years. This is total increase in research funding. For that university, the increase has been double that. And don't forget that this period matches exactly the period when that university began making its research open access. Now, happily, Universities Australia, the overarching body for those universities, makes all these data public. And so we have started to delve into what is behind this big increase, this very successful increase in finding research funding by QUT. And I can tell you that a considerable proportion of this is coming in from industry. So now we're going out to those industries to ask them how they found out that QUT was doing the kind of research that was useful for them. Oh, sorry. This is one more testimony from a lady at that university who puts her work in the repository, and she's effectively saying here, I've put my work in the repository, somebody in an industry in Australia has noticed it, he thinks it's great, he's been in touch, we're now going to be working with him. So this is the kind of story that seems to be emerging from open access. We're not just talking about access for the research community, but for the wider community too. And finally, for institutions, a repository does all these things. It fulfills the university's original mission about doing research and disseminating it. It allows a university to form a complete and permanent record of its work. It is a research management tool that allows research managers to evaluate and monitor and manage the research in the university better. And it's definitely a marketing tool, as you now understand. And it provides maximum web impact for the institution. This is the G-Factor University Rankings. It's a measure of web impact for a university's web offerings. At the top of that ranking of 5,000 universities around the world sit all the big American Ivy League universities, as you would expect. The pink ones here, because this is normally given to a British audience, are Oxford and Cambridge universities. These are our two top universities appearing in the top tranche here. But remember that there are another 5,000 universities underneath this. Then we go a little further down and we see UCL, Paul, the third pink bar, and Yale down here at the bottom. And then you can see a white bar, I hope you can, and the light's not great in this room, but between the second and third pink ones, you can see a white one. That is Southampton. Now, Southampton's a good research university, but it is in no other kind of rankings does it appear in the top 30 universities in the world. But it's doing so in this one, which is measuring web impact for other universities. It's measuring the number of links from universities to a university's web offering. So it's a measure of web impact. And Southampton's enjoying that because it has a huge amount of content in its open access repository. I mentioned the one at the School of Electronics, but it also has a university-wide repository with something like 60 or 70,000 articles in it now. So it gets that impact. Remember that graph? Let's say 50% increase in citation impact with open access. And I'm just going to finally finish up with working through what that means to the University of Vienna. In 2009, in the Web of Science, the University of Vienna published 4,396 articles. The number of citations to those articles was a little over 4,000. If they had all been open access, the university would have enjoyed that 50% increase in citations that open access brings. So you would have had over 6,000 citations for those articles. But there's more to it than that. If we say the university invests 100 million euros in research, now I don't know if that's true, it's a guess. Some of you in this room do know what the figure is, but let's say it's 100 million. You're losing citation impact worth 50 million euros simply by keeping your work hidden in subscription publications. In other words, to buy that amount of extra impact that open access brings for nothing, you would have had to pull in an extra 50 million euros in research funding. No wonder then that the number of policies are rising around the world for open access. This is the way they've been growing over the last few years. The important thing to look at here is the red part of these bars. The blue bits are funder policies, research funders, and the Austrian Research Foundation has a policy, a mandatory policy. But the growth has been at institutional level, the red bit. That's where all the activity is happening, in universities, as rector after rector sees what open access can do for his or her institution. And we expect this graph to keep going up like that in the future. So to finish off with, I take you back two centuries to the first president of Johns Hopkins University, who said about the role of a university that it is one of the noblest duties of a university to advance knowledge and to diffuse it, not just to those who can attend the daily lectures, but far and wide. I think in the last half a century, we've lost that a little bit, that ethos, but it's coming back. Universities are now seeing the benefit of open access, and that's actually stated in the current mission statement for the University of Edinburgh, for example, which says, our mission is the creation, dissemination, and curation of knowledge, and that is what it should be for all universities. I finish, this is my last slide, with pointers to two resources. One is OASIS, which has been written for researchers and librarians. It is a resource about open access, gives you all the data that I've given you here, plus lots more to make your case. And the other one is called Enabling Open Scholarship. This is an organization set up for people at rector and vice-rector level who wish to help promote and advance open scholarship as a whole. So not just open access, but lots of other open things that go with opening up scholarship, as Paul mentioned at the end of his talk there. And so for those of you who are going back to universities now, I urge you to take that URL and a message from me, an invitation to your pro-rector or your rector, indeed, if you think he or she would be interested, and ask them to look at that site and ask them if they would like to join us as we move scholarly communication into this century. Thank you very much for listening.
Many thanks, Alma. We are a bit late in our schedule, so I can take one question over there.
Hi, great talk, thank you. My name is Uli Technau and I'm a professor at the Faculty for Life Science, so biology. And the question I have is, we're more and more encouraged to publish in high impact paper journals, and that actually has a direct effect now on our budgets that we get from the university, etc. And among those high impact journals like Nature, Cell, etc., Science, how often is that actually in conflict, the open access policy with the policy of these kind of journals? So how often is and how we would like to deal with this in the future?
Okay. The journals that you mentioned all have a policy about open access, and they allow you to put your work in a repository. There are some journals that don't allow you to do this. So if you routinely publish in journals that don't allow it, then there you have to take another tack. But for those ones that you've mentioned, they do allow it, and your library will advise you on the specifics of their policy. There is, of course, PLOS Biology, which is now up there with Nature and Science as a very high impact journal, and that is an open access journal. So you, and PLOS Medicine, of course, so you do have, I don't know quite what your research is, but you do have those as open access outlets themselves. But there is a service where you can look up the policy of all, well, as many journals as this service has currently covered. It's called Sherpa Romeo, and again, your library or repository people will advise how to find that. You look up the journal that you want to publish in. It shows you whether they allow you to put your work in a repository and make it open access, and then you just abide by their,
yep,
their
just
policy.
A short comment, but this possibility to have open access in, say, Nature or PNAS or whatever, it's costing a lot of money.
So okay. You're talking then about paying a fee to publish in an open access journal. Well, that's the topic of this afternoon's program. Yes, it does cost a lot of money, but that is a different type of open access. That is paying the journal to make your work open access for you. What I've been talking about here is publishing in the journal that you want to publish in, not paying them anything. They just publish as usual, and they sell a subscription. But at the same time, you put your work in the repository and make it open access. So you're doing the making open access. The journal is doing what it always does. And that's completely compatible. And it doesn't cost you anything.